ABD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I am happy to be at one of the most amazing places in southeast Wisconsin, the Kenosha Public Museum. And I'm standing here with its executive director, Dan Joyce, and with its now retired director of interpretation, Nancy Matthews. And the two of them are joining me on what should be a wonderful, illuminating walk through the newest exhibit at the Kenosha Public Museum, namely an exhibit called From Curiosity to Science, which really helps sort of untangle the whole notion of what science is and when did human beings begin to think in scientific terms about the world around them. And so I'm excited about this. And Dan Joyce, Nancy Matthews, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Good morning, Greg.
Good to have you here. So we're standing in the beautiful second floor atrium of the Kenosha Public Museum and looking out at a spectacular view, but there's even more spectacular things inside the museum. Ahead of us walking through, Dan, just say a word about what you regard as the central mission of the Kenosha Public Museum.
The mission of the Kenosha Public Museum is to educate and stimulate curiosity. That's it. That's what it's all about. It's about lifelong learning.
And Nancy Matthews, you for many years were a part of the museum staff. This is probably a little strange for you to be visiting after so many years being here. How long were you at the museum, and explain in particular your final title here?
I was with the museum 29 plus years, 29 years and a few months, and my final title was Director of Interpretation. So I oversaw the Education, Exhibits, and Collections departments, and the last couple of years, my tenure at the museum, was the project manager for the exhibit we're going to see today.
From Curiosity to Science. Okay. Ahead of us visiting that, Dan, give us an overview of what is housed within these four walls.
Well, the Kenosha Public Museum is a natural history and art museum. One of the things that we wanted to do with this particular exhibit was get more of our natural history items out. We have lots of items in storage, as most museums do. They are study collections. They are potential exhibit collections. They are things we put out on temporary exhibits. But it's always nice to get some things out long-term as well. You will see on the first floor the Wisconsin story. And this is really it's more than the Wisconsin story. It's actually a regional story, about a 6-7 state story from kind of the beginning of time, but all the way through about 1835 when Kenosha is established. So we look at prehistoric life in this area through time. We look at the Ice Age extensively because Wisconsin, of course, is the Ice Age laboratory. The last most recent Ice Age is called the Wisconsinan. Because there's so much research that had been done in the early days in Wisconsin. If you know what to look for when you're driving around Wisconsin, you can see a lot of glacial activity. So that's a main thrust of our exhibit down there. Obviously, our mammoths are associated with that, that we excavated years ago. And then we end up with our Potawatomi, Native Americans coming into the continent, and most recently the Potawatomi Village that was in this area before Kenosha was founded as a Euro-American city in 1835. Yeah.
A lot of Kenoshans will understand why the building looks like it does from the outside, but for the sake of anybody listening or watching who doesn't know the story, when one approaches the Kenosha Public Museum, why does it look the way it does? Its distinctive look is for a very important reason.
It is very distinctive. We have basically a glass wedge going through the middle of the building. This represents glaciers going through Wisconsin. We have a till wall, which is actually kind of what previous glaciers left behind, that this particular glaciation is cutting through. It's not a real till wall, but real till walls are about 90% dirt. This one's all rock.
It's too pretty.
So this glass atrium, we're in a sense standing in the middle of the glacier that splits the museum.
It really represents the main story we talk about, which is really the Ice Age. That's the main focus of the museum. And then the aftermath of the Ice Age with the Native Americans hunting mammoths and then Native Americans obviously occupying this area up until Euro-Americans come in and settle.
And there's copper accents on both the inside and the outside of the building because mixed up with that glacial till and all of the dirt and sand were chunks of raw copper ore, which the American Indians picked up, realized if you hit it with a rock, it'll change shape, and they were able to fashion it into tools.
Fantastic. So before we step into this very special exhibit, Dan, I want you to explain why Nancy Matthews has been wrenched out of quiet retirement to join us today. I mean, it wouldn't be right to not have her with us, but explain to our listeners and viewers why.
Well, Nancy's role in this exhibit was really the project manager. She did everything. She coordinated contractors. She did the research. She got the scientists involved that we'll talk about in a little while. She got Harborside students involved in the project. She saw it from the very genesis, the very idea, to the final product, and coordinated everything. So that was a big job.
But you forgot the most important thing was dusting all of the animals.
Well, yes, that is an essential job.
The feather duster, yes, we don't want to forget that. So, Nancy, describe in general what we are going to experience or what anybody experiences when they walk through this exhibit, again called From Curiosity to Science.
Well, the title kind of describes it. It starts with human curiosity about the world, and as explorers, we're leaving Europe and going out and exploring the four corners of our globe, coming back to Europe with all of these curiosities. People were acquiring them for their own enjoyment, and so over time these curiosities were just displayed in cabinets and then over time into rooms, and they became what we now know as our public museums today. So natural sciences grew out of this curiosity, and men of science started comparing things that were being brought back from all corners of the world and seeing similarities and differences between the two, and naming systems. The binomial naming system developed by Linnaeus is what we still use today. So we have that whole history of natural sciences and how the natural sciences came to be. And then we look at how we study natural sciences today, looking at six very broadly defined ecosystems, looking at a local example, a global example, and then illustrations of those and the research that is being done by scientists today.
Very good. So we are going to step into this exhibit, again called From Curiosity to Science, in just a moment after some underwriting announcements. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD.
See your future on the horizon? So do we. At Carthage College, we will push you to dive deep, to channel your curiosity, and excel in your chosen field. Some things you just need to see for yourself. Come take a closer look at Carthage College.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. For over 100 years, they've been celebrating spring with the finest in Easter treats, from their famous pectin jelly beans to solid milk and dark chocolate bunnies. They'll help you assemble the perfect Easter basket for your loved ones. 2401 60th Street, Kenosha.
And for those of you just joining us, this is The Morning Show on WGTD and a very special edition of The Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. And The Morning Show comes to you today from the Kenosha Public Museum in downtown Kenosha. I'm joined by Executive Director Dan Joyce and by the now retired Nancy Matthews. When she retired just a few months ago, it was as Director of Interpretation, and Nancy had a very direct hand in what we are about to see, the incredible objects that are on display in this new exhibit called From Curiosity to Science. So we are going to be taking you on a little walkthrough journey from curiosity to science. And this is an incredible way to open the exhibit as we explore the whole nature of human curiosity. So we are looking at extraordinary array of objects that I understand come from the museum's extensive archives. just how huge an archive are we talking about, Dan?
Between the three museums, we have about 100,000 objects, probably around 80,000 for the Kenosha Public Museum. That's the bulk of them. Natural history specimens pile up quite quickly.
Right. And so this is just a small sampling, albeit a generous sampling, of what is found in those archives. And so, Nancy, if I remember correctly, part of what happens here is that this portion of the exhibit takes us through this development of these so-called curiosity cabinets and curiosity rooms, the precursors of what we think of now as museums. So what about this that we're looking at now represents the 1600s? I mean, what would be the characteristics of a curiosity cabinet or room from this period?
Well, those early cabinets of curiosities were just kind of jam-packed with everything. There is very little organization to them. As you can see, there are things on the wall, things hanging from the ceiling, things on the floor. And this, the way the museum has designed this room is really based on one of the images that we have on the graphic panel, a very early cabinet of curiosity by a man by the name of Ole Worm. And so if you look at that graphic, you can see that there are arrows hanging on the back wall. We've replicated that. There is a tortoiseshell hanging on the wall. So really, that was kind of our blueprint for the 1600s.
So this would be very typical of what a curiosity room looked like at this point in time. And so where would these kind of things come from? I mean, we see these small little specimens of turtles and birds and so on. So how is it that someone would have something like this in their possession, and how would it come into the possession of the museum?
Well, actually, it's pretty varied. We have a lot of collectors of various things and that donate to us. And these objects, some of them are scientifically collected, some of them are hobby collected, and then given to us over time. So that's how we get them. How they got them in the 1600s is, of course, through trade. We have merchants, traders, we have wealthy folk that are collecting these materials. We have a royalty that are creating cabinets as well. And as Nancy said, this is very disorganized. It's just a collection of things in a room. This is really the very beginnings. We got the 1500s and the 1600s when the curiosity cabinets are just masses of objects. By the time we start getting into the Enlightenment in the 1700s, we start to get some scientific organization, and that's where we would go to next, to our next cabinet.
So that's where we step. I got to say, though, there's something really splendid about even this amazing disorganization, if you will. It's still incredible. And for those only hearing us and not seeing us, we're looking at four or five shelves filled with all kinds of different specimens, geological specimens as well, and it goes floor to ceiling. It's really incredible. And so this is where it all starts, and this is where this exhibit starts. All right, so we're going to step down to the next, and Nancy, explain what we see in this second curiosity room.
Well, we are now in the 1700s, and Dan can best describe his thought process for how this came to be. But we start to see a little bit more organization. The birds are all together. We've got a cabinet that's just full of all kinds of sea life, with corals and starfish and sea urchins and bottled specimens. And visitors to the museum, just keep an eye out for some very quirky kinds of specimens that you might see in these cabinets. Museum staff have a great sense of humor, so I'm not going to say any more, but I'll let Dan explain his thought process and how this cabinet came to be.
What's really fortunate for us, Nancy mentioned an engraving for the 1600s, is a lot of these rooms were actually drawn up by artists and engraved in books. And then there were inventories of what was in these cabinets of curiosity.
So you don't have to just look at the engraving. You have a very detailed, specific record.
Exactly. And that really helped us for all of these different cabinets that we're looking at. This particular cabinet is a bit of an amalgamation. On the sides, we have two cabinets that are brown wood. They are English cabinets. You can tell stylistically they're kind of English looking. The one in the back looks very, very different. It's bright white, painted white. It has ornate carvings all over it. It is full of specimens of coral and sea life of various sorts. It has snake carvings around the edges of the windows. This is actually based on a French cabinet. There was a whole, actually there still are, a whole series of cabinets like this that are a little bit bigger than what we see here. We had to scale it down in order to make it fit. But there's one after the other that still exist in France and still have their cabinet contents. There are folks around who seek out these cabinets in Europe. A lot of them still exist. And some of them ended up being museums.
So the cabinets exist, and everything that was housed in them still exists as well.
Yes.
And I think your contention is that this represents a different sort of system of thought, that the whole purpose behind creating this or amassing this is coming from, in a sense, a little different mindset that's closer to what we think of as science.
Very much so. This is the very beginning of science in many ways. Natural science in particular. We have these people going all over the globe, and we start to have scientific expeditions even with these people going all over the globe. It's just an amazing time during the Enlightenment when we have science like this developing, and categorization, I should say, or I can say maybe, as Nancy said, the genus and species, our binomial naming system, comes about at this time. And this is because we have specimens that these people were looking at. They can compare, contrast, look at different families of materials, and scientifically classify them.
I was just going to say, if we go to the bottom of the cabinet, I can't even count them all, but all of the starfish. I mean, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. That's just what I can easily see from where I'm standing. And just at a glance, we understand the extraordinary variety of just starfish. And only when you take those specimens and kind of put them side by side do we start to realize that this is a complex being that comes in all shapes and sizes. And it's amazing, absolutely amazing, and beautiful.
It's the same with the corals as well, because the whole back of the cabinet is this wonderful variety of corals in different colors as well. So again, just showing the variety from all over the world of just one particular kind of animal.
Incredible.
And in addition to that, we have liquid specimens starting to be collected. You can see jars with clear liquid in them with different animals of various sorts.
Very good. Yeah, that's an advancement that we don't stop to sort of calculate or think that is that means something in the history of science.
Exactly. And if you go to a natural history museum today and you get into their storage area, they are full of liquid specimens that are studied by scientists.
All right, so we should, although I feel like we could stand here all day just looking at each of these curiosity rooms or curiosity cabinets, or I guess we're talking about rooms filled with cabinets in this case. And now we're all the way to the 1800s, and this represents still further advancement?
Exactly, and actually this room is based on Charles Wilson Peale's museum in Philadelphia, which was the first natural history or first public museum in the United States. So Peale was really a Renaissance man. He was an author. He was a statesman, a soldier, and a naturalist and an artist. And
wow.
The image that is on the door through which we walked is Charles Wilson Peale welcoming us in, and that is taken from the self-portrait he did of his museum in Philadelphia, pulling back the red velvet curtain, welcoming people in.
Incredible. And this is really something with all kinds of specimens. Dan, what should we be sure to appreciate about this?
Well, Charles Wilson Peale's museum, the Peale Museum in Philadelphia, is just a wonderful example of an early, early museum in the United States. Museums had been around in Europe since the late 1600s. 1680s was really the first one at Oxford that was open to the public, more or less. And this one is the first one in the United States. So you see all kinds of birds and mammals. You see Native American items as well, cultural materials that are collected from the West. It's an interesting mix of things, but you can see it's really starting to be more organized. Again, we have a mastodon jaw. The museum was involved in an excavation of a mastodon. Down on our label at the bottom is a copy of an illustration, a watercolor of the museum. So we just did a miniature version of the museum. You can see in the illustration that, you know, that goes much deeper than what we were able to replicate, but it gives you the feel of one of the early museums.
Right. And I noticed from that information that this is a museum that no longer operates. I was about to call my brother, who lives in Philadelphia, and tell him, make sure you get to the Peale Museum. That's not going to be possible. But in a sense, what a great service you're doing to his legacy that although that museum does not exist anymore, in a sense, you're giving us a taste of it.
Absolutely. And it's a fun thing to do. And this is actually one of my favorite areas. I really like the 1600s because of the chaos. And I really like this because it's an early museum. A lot of these early museums in Europe and the United States really come about by collections of cabinets of curiosity. You know, you get two or three or four collections together and they form a museum. The British Museum in London is a massive cabinet that was donated, and that was the origin of the British Museum.
And, of course, the whole idea is that this is so amazing and I shouldn't just enjoy this myself. Myself and my family and my closest friends, let's have the public take in some of these things and enjoy them.
And you'll also notice that, like in standard museum exhibits, you know, an object would have a label. None of the objects have labels. So you're here just to, you know, be curious and marvel at these wonderful specimens from nature.
Right, and then take them in and wonder, what in the world is that incredible bird? Very good. Wonderful. So it looks like towards the very end of this portion of the exhibit is something that takes us a little closer to the modern-day museum.
Well, since we transitioned from cabinets of curiosities to museums, we wanted to look at our museum storage and a typical museum storage. This is what you see in a museum storage area. Cabinets, lots of drawers full of all sorts of different wonderful objects, both cultural and natural. And it's very, very similar to a cabinet of curiosity that's organized in many ways. So that's, we wanted to show that similarity as well.
That's incredible. So this is just, again, a tiny sampling of the museum's archive. How did you choose these particular objects to be part of this exhibit?
Well, we wanted to kind of show the breadth of the museum's collections. So we have the natural science collections over on the right side with minerals down on the bottom, fossils. We've got bones. Skeletal pieces. I believe that's from one particular animal. I think it's a wolf. The variety of turtles that we have. Then we have study skins. So most people are familiar with taxidermy specimens in a museum that are in lifelike positions. But we have a pretty extensive collection of study skins that were preserved just for that, just for study. And then the top drawer on that cabinet shows eggs. We have a lot of bird eggs.
And this is just a few of them. I mean, this is by no means all the eggs that the museum has.
It's just the tip of the iceberg. And then the other cabinet shows, to the left, shows several of representative samples of cultural objects. So we've got one entire drawer of shoes. We have bags, we have musical instruments, we have things from the Americas, things from Asia, things from Africa. And then the shelving unit behind that cabinet, we have some more of our natural science specimens. There's a polar bear skull, there's a lion skull, we've got some owls and iguana, just to really show the breadth of our collections.
I can tell from some of the labels that I can read that they specify where these came from. I mean, these butterflies, for instance, belong to a certain family. I can't quite make out the name, but so that's part of how these are labeled, at least in many cases, by where they came from, who from whom they came. I also wonder, though, when it comes to labeling things, identifying exactly what this is. Is that sometimes a matter of supposition or educated guess?
No, it's actually a part of research. We do some extensive research quite often when we need to identify something that's not identified in the collection, and that happens every once in a while. Fortunately, quite a bit of our natural history collection is really identified fairly well. Location and who donated it and things like that are extremely well documented, but sometimes the specimens, species are a little shaky, so we have to do a little more research on that. This is just, like we said, the tip of the iceberg is what you're seeing here. We have, behind us are some shells in another small cabinet in the hallway here. We have 12,000 shells. We probably have 2,000 or 3,000 eggs. Baskets and pottery, we have hundreds from around the world. Mineral specimens, we probably have another several thousand mineral specimens from around the world again. The great thing about this museum is that from the natural history aspect and even the cultural aspect, we're not looking at just this area. We're looking at collections from around the world, and we have scientists come in and study our study collections. We have a study collection of insects that were collected in Beaver Dam around the turn of the previous century by a gentleman. In the 1950s, when that collection came to us, there were 70,000 specimens, beetle specimens. Unfortunately, they were quite eaten up by other live insects. So we have about 7,000 left in the cabinets, and we've had scientists come and study those about three times now, just that collection, because it's well known.
And we could probably spend a whole morning show just talking about how you preserve things properly, but there's no time, I'm afraid.
Yeah, the cabinet that's on the left, the bottom drawer, is shoes. And that was a very – part of those shoes are part of a collection that came in recently. And there was no information on them.
Yep.
And our curator of collections, Gina Redant, asked me to do some research and try and identify them. And it was so much fun. Mm-hmm. Trolling the internet, trying to find, and I was able to identify several pairs of shoes just from articles and websites I found. But there were probably about three or four pairs that I could not identify. And there is a shoe museum in Toronto, Canada. And I sent images, and they were able to give us further identifying information about those shoes.
So no educated guesses here at the Kenosha Belt Museum. All right, so this is just the opening portion of this incredible exhibit. And again, for those of you just joining us, we are talking about the Kenosha Public Museum's new exhibit called From Curiosity to Science. We step into this next area, and it looks like there's a screen where a film is shown. What is shown in this film?
We have an introductory film in this area that really talks about the Cabinets of Curiosity and the transition to museums and the development of natural science. It's a short film, puts it in everything in the context, and it gets you ready for the next section that you will see where we talk about various ecosystems, and we'll get into in a minute.
Very good. So we're going to watch just a bit of this.
Curiosity. It is something that makes us uniquely human. From the beginning of humankind, people have searched for answers to explain the world around them. Studying, pondering, questioning. We have looked at nature and sought to discover our place within. In the late 17th century, a new age of science was born. The age of exploration brought European travelers to all corners of the globe, and aristocrats and scholars sought to understand their own place in such a large world. They began collecting, studying the plants, animal specimens, and artifacts that
these travelers. All right, so this introductory film is a nice little addition. We should probably step a little away from the sound, but I want people to see this important sign which says Featured Ecosystems, and this is something that is really important to understand this next phase of the exhibit. And Nancy, I know this is something that was important to you, so how do we explore these ecosystems in this next phase?
Well, the rest of the exhibit looks at six very broadly defined ecosystems: water, wetlands, grasslands, forest, polar, and arid. And we look at a local example and compare that with a global example. We look at all of the different wildlife and as well as human cultures in each of those ecosystems. We look at the challenges each of those ecosystems faces. How are they alike? How are they different? And what are the challenges that those ecosystems are are facing. And you'll notice that they're all color-coded, which that color coding plays through as we walk through the exhibit. You'll notice that the exhibit cases are color-coded with the graphics so that as you're moving from one ecosystem to another, it's pretty easy to determine when you're leaving water and going to grasslands.
Very good. So we'll just kind of step in here and try to take in kind of the broad sweep of all of this. And so I guess it was no question that there are these six basic kinds of ecosystems, or six of the most important that you wanted to examine. So in what way does this take us to the next level towards science?
Well, we are looking again at some of our collections, and in addition, I worked with 120 ninth graders from Harborside who interviewed scientists who are working in each of these ecosystems to really highlight that natural science is taking place right here in southeast Wisconsin.
Wow, and it's studying these various specimens. So let's step around here, and maybe in the middle of let's take a look at all these. This is arid, and some amazing foxes.
Yes. Because we don't have a desert here in Kenosha, but we have sand dunes. And so we're looking at the Kenosha sand dunes, comparing them with the Sonoran Desert. How are they alike? How are they different? They both have sand. They both have cactus. But obviously, they're very different environments. But we do have representative animals that can be seen on the sand dunes of Kenosha, and comparing that with the Sonoran Desert with the animals. Now, some of them are similar. You find coyotes in both environments. You might find fox in both environments. You find snakes, but the snakes are different. So we've chosen the specimens so that you can make those comparisons very easily between the two examples.
How about these spectacular specimens that are behind us in a part of the exhibit called Predator and Prey?
Well, this is part of the polar ecosystem. And for polar, we're comparing actually three different ecosystems, the Arctic, the Antarctic, and Ice Age Wisconsin. So how were these three ecosystems alike? And basically, one of the common denominators is they were covered with ice, or are covered with ice. So standing next to us are some of our wonderful specimens from the Arctic. We have a polar bear, we have an Arctic wolf, the muskox. That was a definite challenge when I was vacuuming and cleaning that. We have an Arctic fox, we have a wolverine, and Dan might want to talk about the harbor seal that is there.
The harbor seal is a veteran of the Columbian Exposition. It was years and years and years and years ago, I worked at the Field Museum, as did Nancy. And while I was working there in the early 1980s, they were redoing the Northwest Coast and Eskimo Inuit Hall. And they were throwing out old specimens left and right, and the staff asked if we can take things home. And they said, fine. So this guy actually was at the World's Columbian Exposition, so in the 1893, and became part of the Field Museum collection. And then he was in my basement for about 20 years. And then I gave him to the museum.
this is where he belongs, yes. He or she. Very good. Let's take the time to look at a couple of more things in this amazing part of the exhibit. And, one of my favorite birds, the pileated woodpecker. So maybe we should just talk for a moment about this wonderful example of the forest ecosystem.
We're in the forest ecosystem, and in forests we're comparing the temperate rainforest of the Pacific Northwest coast with petrifying springs. Now, if you ask anybody about petrifying springs today, some will say, if you ask my husband, he'll say it's a golf course. Others will say it's a beer garden. Others, it's a dog park. And still others, it's a wonderful place to hike through the woods. And so we have a nice representative sample of some of the animals from petrifying springs that you could find in petrifying springs or a forest in general in the upper Midwest. And one of the unique things is right in front of the case, there is a rock, which is the petrified mineralization from water of the springs, which is what gave Petrifying Springs its name. The scientist that we focus on for the forest is Dr. Bob Sasso from Parkside, and he talks in the video kiosk that we have. His interview focuses on the archaeology that he and Dan have done in Petrifying Springs, both prehistoric archaeology as well as historic archaeology.
Nancy, maybe you could explain also down in front of the exhibit is something that almost looks a little bit like a book. It's not quite a book, but that's meant to enhance the experience of those who visit this exhibit.
It is. Actually, each of the six ecosystems has a physical interactive. So we have like magnifying glasses. There is a scent interactive for wetlands. And for forest, we have a flip book that talks about the threats and success stories of forest. So, of course, one of the huge issues facing forests in our area has been the emerald ash borer. We are, I guess, thankful that the polar vortex actually wiped out about 85% of the emerald ash borer larvae. So this is going to be less of a problem going forward. But thousands and thousands of trees in Kenosha County have been cut down because of the emerald ash borer. So the flip book just illustrates some of the different problems facing forests around the world today.
Just in Petrifying Springs alone, they cut down 2,000 ash trees because of the emerald ash borer.
Not a good thing. So I'm glad the polar vortex, there was some good that came out of it. So just in our last couple of minutes, one more thing maybe that you want to have us see and explore. The polar. Yeah, this looks really interesting. Oh, this looks amazing. What do you want to tell us about what we're seeing in this polar display?
Well, we have a lot of cultural objects in the polar display. And on this side of the case that we're looking at right now is primarily things from the Arctic. And we've got a parka, an Inuit parka, and boots and mittens. And we've got a few wildlife things as well. On the other side of the case, we actually have some very interesting objects that were donated to the museum by one of the museum volunteers. Her cousin, I think it's cousin, was on one of the expeditions with Bert, and actually was responsible for handling the dogs. And so she donated to the museum his photo album, his wrist compass, and several other objects that he used when he was on this expedition of, you know, exploring. And that's what we've been talking about, is exploring and discovering our world. So that kind of brings it into more modern times.
Nancy, I'm trying to imagine what it feels like for you to stand in the midst of this spectacular exhibit, in the sense not only that you had a lot to do with putting it together, but also that in a sense it's such a magnificent representation about why people like you and Dan go into the business of museums. I mean, in so many ways, this seems representative of what so much of your life has been about.
Exactly. And in working on this exhibit, I've delved much more deeply than I ever had into the natural sciences, and it particularly environmental education and environmental sciences. And to work with the scientists that I had the pleasure to work with was just an absolute joy, and to highlight the work that is being done in Southeast Wisconsin today.
Very good. I know that we want to finish with this spectacular image right here, this spectacular specimen. Say something about this, Dan.
This is something that we recently acquired from another museum. It was actually a nature center in Ohio that had donated quite a few African specimens to us. The giraffe is pretty amazing. He is just so huge, and it's only, unfortunately, it's only a part of him, but we certainly couldn't fit all of them into this gallery. Another, you know, representative of the amazing grasslands of Africa.
and a wonderful climactic moment for this incredible exhibit, again called From Curiosity to Science, which in so many ways represents the world of the museum, the world of science, the world of discovery, and all that it entails. So Dan Joyce, the executive director of the Kenosha Public Museum, and Nancy Matthews, out of retirement as director of interpretation and one of the people who had a very close hand in the creation and dusting of this exhibit. I'm so glad both of you made time in your busy schedules to take us through, and we certainly encourage our listeners and those watching to view this in person, and it's that's the real way to enjoy and experience the splendor of all this. Thank you for being part of the morning show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Greg.
I'm Gregory Berg.
See your future on the horizon? So do we. At Carthage College, we will push you to dive deep, to channel your curiosity, and excel in your chosen field. Some things you just need to see for yourself. Come take a closer look at Carthage College.
Where WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. For over 100 years, they've been celebrating spring with the finest in Easter treats, from their famous pectin jelly beans to solid milk and dark chocolate bunnies. They'll help you assemble the perfect Easter basket for your loved ones. 2401 60th Street, Kenosha.
To finish out today's morning show, we're going to turn to a brief but memorable conversation recorded back in 2006 with one of America's most intriguing creative geniuses, Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple Computers with Steve Jobs. The occasion of this conversation was the publication of Wozniak's best-selling memoir, I Was, Computer Geek to Cult Icon, How I Invented the Personal Computer, Co-Founded Apple, and Had Fun Doing It, published by W.W. Norton & Company. I began by asking Steve Wozniak to talk about his book's breezy and unassuming writing style.
I have no book experience, but Gina said we should get an agent. We got an agent. He sold the book. In each of the book publishers that bought it, they contacted me on the phone, and they said, we want to do this book, but we want it in Steve's voice. So what I did was I spoke into a tape recorder. Gina, you know, edited it together. Then we went through it paragraph by paragraph to make sure that it sounded the way I talk naturally in the world, for genuineness. I love genuine.
Well, that's certainly what this book is. I have really enjoyed it so thoroughly. One of the things that you do in your book is that you really give credit where credit is due in terms of how you came to have this marvelous genius for inventing new things. And we see that credit being given to a number of different people, but in particular, some of the teachers who really nurtured these promising gifts you had as a young person.
Very lucky. Actually, one teacher made me so inspired that I really believed in wanted to be a teacher like her someday, teaching fifth grade, which I did in my life. It's in the book. I also had another teacher in electronics who found a way to get me educated in a company outside of school where they had computers that we didn't have, something he felt that I could learn about.
Something that was interesting, too, about computers, one of the first things when you saw them, even back in the days when they were huge and not accessible to regular people, you said computers were actually kind of simple the closer you looked at them. And this is part of the insight which helped you develop them for all of us to use.
That's the funny thing. Computers work on zeros and ones. I mean, we've already learned how to add digits 0 through 9. So zeros and ones, you learn how to add them, and you say, well, God, anybody can learn this. You don't need calculus. You don't need trigonometry. You don't need differential equations.
One of the things that was interesting about your personality, maybe to this day, is that you were quite a shy person, and you said that your clever designs were in some ways a more comfortable way for you to communicate with others, to socialize with others through the designs you made.
It was a huge advantage to me that I had a lot of very unusual techniques. Actually doing anything unusual, different than other people did, would get a little bit of attention that I had no way to get on my own being so shy.
One of the greatest things about your story is that you visited a group called the Homebrew Computer Club back in 1975, a bunch of
people like you who are interested in computers. But you kind of misunderstood what that group was about. And if you hadn't had that misunderstanding, you probably never would have gone to that first meeting. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
I was scared of things that I didn't know about. And I didn't know about these new chips called microprocessors that had evolved. I had sort of missed out on that. So I would not have gone to a meeting dealing with microprocessors. But a friend, just by coincidence, has said, it's a meeting for people with video terminals. I had just designed one. So I thought, God, I'll show off my design. I'll pass it out. I'll be a big star in this new club. So I went, and what I discovered was, oh, my gosh, I now know a formula for building this computer I wanted my whole life.
Well, and because you had been playing around with televisions and with things like that old game Pong and some other things, you were actually building up a technical know-how, which was really going to come in handy then when you created this new idea of a computer with a screen.
Yeah, well, I had the technical know-how from very early years, actually going back to elementary school, a very good computer know-how, and I got so good at designing things. But more than that, I like to do, when I came home from Hewlett-Packard working on calculators, I like to do other interesting electronic things of the day, like hotel movie systems. Pong games started up, the first video games. And so I actually designed my own versions. The only way I could ever get something was to build it myself because I couldn't afford to buy the real thing. And then I built a terminal that would talk to what was called the ARPANET, which is the early forerunner of today's Internet, started by the U.S. military, by DARPA. It was called the ARPANET. And I discovered it, and I had to build a machine that could type to computers far away on this ARPANET just so I could, I don't know, feel proud that I had one. And so all these little things that I did all wound up converging on the Apple II computer eventually.
One of the most extraordinary things about what you developed and began marketing, of course, with Steve Jobs and this new company called Apple, is that very early on in this process, you had no copyrights or patents on any of these things that you were designing and developing, and you would show it to everybody. There was this marvelous openness about the way you were doing this.
To me, the club was sharing and helping others get to a better place in life, and I was going to help other people build their own computer themselves. You can have your own. Here's the design. Copy mine. Steve Jobs came along later and said, let's start a company to sell a piece of it called a PC board for $40. And eventually, the local store talked us into selling whole computers. So we didn't really just go out gung-ho and say, let's start a computer company. And after the computer was designed and I was giving it out for free, we didn't say, let's start a computer company. Step by step, it's just that the demand was there.
A quick question about Apple. When it started, you said it was an engineering-centric model of a company. It became more of a marketing-driven company. That was something you were a little less comfortable with. Explain what that difference is.
Well, in Hewlett-Packard, where I worked, we built the products that engineers use to design other things. We built their oscilloscopes. We built their power supplies. We built their signal their calculators, their engineering calculators. So we understood the market, and we were in control of deciding what products should come next. We had very good minds in that regard. And the Apple II, the Apple I and II computers, I designed them all alone in my own room just for myself. And so it was easy to, so I was totally driven by engineering, what chips were available. When we started the company with real money, we brought in this marketing guy, and he said, no, the success is going to be really a marketing success. We have to be a marketing-driven company, understand needs of the users.
Interesting.
So Apple was run differently than Hewlett-Packard, but we weren't making products precisely for engineers. We were making them for everyday average people.
And for your own
engineer is not a good judge of that.
Right. But you were designing things for your own enjoyment, and the rest is history. The book is I Was, the author Steve Wozniak. Steve Wozniak, congratulations on a superb book. And I'm glad we got to talk about it today.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Greg.
By the way, if you enjoyed part one of today's morning show and the tour through From Curiosity to Science, you can see it for yourself. That walking tour visually is preserved on WGTD's Facebook page, which is WGTD-FM. Tomorrow on the morning show, a conversation about the tremendous work done by Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services. They have been serving Kenosha for over 50 years with 600 volunteers offering 16 different services to the elderly and families. And we will be talking about all that as well as a major fundraising event which they have coming up in early May. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. It's archived at WGTD.org. And The Morning Show is also available at